Angela, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you doing, Corey?
It's kind of fallish out there.
It's nice. Is. It's lovely.
Got a little jacket on.
It makes me want to crawl up with a book.
Yeah? Yeah, this is a kind of a book club, movie club edition of A Very Okay Podcast. Well, why don't you tell us what we're going to be talking about today?
We are going to be talking about The Outsiders, the book and the movie. And for those of you who do not know, it was written by Essie Hinton. And she is from Oklahoma, still lives in Oklahoma. And the book is set in Tulsa. It's not super obvious, but it is set in Tulsa. Most of us had to read it, I think, in junior high.
I think I was in seventh grade.
So let me ask you this. Did you have to read the book first, or did you watch the movie?
See, I think I had seen parts of the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the characters from the movie were so famous growing up,
right,
that I knew of the movie. I can't really remember. Yeah, my childhood is one big.
Well, what year did the movie come out?
Movie was like 82.
And the book was 67.
67,
okay. So I remember watching the movie as a little kid. I don't remember watching it in the movie theater or anything, but I do remember maybe like, you know, WGN on Sunday afternoon or something like that.
Did you rent it, do you think?
We may have rented it. We didn't get a VCR until I was 11, I think. Yeah, so
Strange. It's hard for me to remember how I consumed media when I was younger. Does that make any sense? Like, I don't understand. We could have rented it, but I don't. Why would I pick a movie from 82 if we were at? I would have picked like.
Well, I don't know. The cool guys. RoboCop. On the front.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it's pretty obvious young girl why you would pick the movie just from the cover. If you guys don't know. Name all the famous actors that were in the movie.
C. Thomas Howell, mm-hmm. Emilio Estevez, mm-hmm. Patrick Swayze, Matt Dillon, Tom Cruise, and a young Rob Lowe.
Yeah.
And Ralph Macchio.
And Ralph Macchio, right. So those were all pretty generic crushes, I think, for a lot of young people.
I would say for a certain generation of girls who had to watch this.
And boys, probably.
In school, you're correct. This was an awakening along with the movie Labyrinth.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're going to ruin probably the plot. So if you haven't seen either the book or the film, we're going to break real quick and allow you to go off and get caught up.
You can go read it real quick.
Okay, we're back. I'm sure you've got all caught up, and if you've never read or seen the movie, and you know a little bit what we're talking about here. So let's talk about Essie Hinton. Mm-hmm. And she began writing this book when she was 15, which is crazy, right?
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I think I was writing really bad poetry at 15.
Ooh, man, I wish you had some of that.
Me too.
And she finished it when she was 16, when she was a junior in high school. And it was published her senior year when she was 18.
Wow. I mean, that just so rarely happened. Well, it really happens now, but it really never happened back then.
We're coming up on the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, it's amazing. And really, it's a book that kind of helped launch the young adult, you know, genre.
It was one of the first kind of...
Like realistic or more heavy or dark?
The kids in this book they're smoking, they're drinking, they're fighting.
Cursing.
They're poor, and it's showing mm-hmm. a side of life that really wasn't talked about in literature aimed at younger people.
Right. And I guess that's one of the reasons why she wanted to write this book was to show what life was like growing up as a teenager.
I read an interview and she talks about how she had a friend that was... jumped and beat up and called a greaser, and she didn't even realize this kid was a greaser, you know?
Right.
So she went home and started pounding out the kind of the draft of the book.
So you mentioned that it's the 50th anniversary. What do you think, what does it spark in people and in especially young adults? Why is it still relevant? I mean, all these years later, there's all these different themes going on that still, you know, relate to what's happening today with teenagers.
There's always going to be people that are different there's always going to be like haves and have nots.
Right. So when you were a teenager, what we had, I guess, the trendies would be what the Sochas are in the book. And I guess the skaters maybe would be the greasers. Was it the same with you?
Yeah, we had, when I was a young 15, 16, I was a skater, which was not cool at the time. This was not a cool time to be a skater in Oklahoma. So, yeah, there were definitely like the preppy kids and then, or the jocks basically. And actually the cowboys, I was more scared of the cowboys.
Right. Yeah, we had the cowboys too.
Yeah. So that, I mean, there are themes that I'm sure it's like that today.
Right. Kind of a universal, I don't know, teenage angst, us versus them and everything. It's also that teenage thinking of everything's kind of black and white. You know, there's you and there's me.
I mean, beyond the teenage struggle, there's also like, there's a murder in this.
Right.
Yeah.
There's
a fight. The popular kids jump these greaser kids.
Rumble.
Yeah, almost. This isn't the rumble. This is just the fight in the park.
Oh, yeah.
And they try to drown this kid and the other greaser kid stabs him. I mean, it's a lot to deal with. And it's super emotional. And that's one thing that this book doesn't talk down to kids. And I think that's...
Right. It doesn't talk down. And I mean, that's one of the beauties of writing it when you are a teenager, I'm sure, is that kind of came through. She was speaking as a peer.
Yeah.
And not as somebody older who's trying to remember what it was like to be a teenager. Because everything is so intense when you're a teenager.
Oh, yeah. Everything's on 11.
Right. And then with the characters in this book, with them being poor... on the wrong side of the tracks. A lot of them had broken family lives. So it really dealt with some heavy topics.
Let's talk about this book in relation to Tulsa as opposed to the movie. In the movie, it's north and south are kind of the sides of the tracks.
Right.
But in the book, it's east and west.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if... Maybe historically, I think the movie is more accurate as far as the north side and south side.
Right. And I think I read somewhere that maybe one of the reasons why, it was the east and west had come out with West Side Story with the gangs.
Okay,
and so they were kind of,
I wonder if that was like a publisher. Alaska S.E. Hinton, if we can ever talk to him.
Yeah.
Also, in the book, there's a lot more references to rural type stuff. Like a character, Sotopov had a horse, and Dallas Winston is talking about making money from rodeo. And there's a bunch of references to kind of a split between, what would today would be like country things and this urban lifestyle. Like they're not so separate. In the movie, none of that is really talked about.
Right. And I don't know if that's, maybe in the late 60s, Tulsa would be more of a kind of... country or have country vibes to it more so than when the movie came out in the 80s.
Yeah, and I think they're trying to make it more of a every city in the movie.
Large city, kind of a big city.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if that would translate. Even though it was real for a large portion of, Oklahoma and probably Texas, I'm not sure if it would translate to...
If you're in California,
Ohio
or Boston.
Yeah. Also, beyond the... You mentioned Broken Home... The main character, his family, is dealing pretty recently with the loss of their parents. And a main theme is a fear of them staying together and not going off in a foster home or something. So, I mean, that's heavy, too. I mean, the strange thing is it doesn't talk about that as much. You know what I mean? But it's this...
Overlying feeling
of...
There's a lot going on just beneath the surface. One thing I do like about the book, too, is that there are these, kind of macho boys, but yet they don't have any problem showing tenderness or feelings towards each other as far as, like hugging or, they're not so macho. And even in the book, they talk about, the Sochas and the greasers, and the greasers are the ones that are so emotional, even if it's like a violent, emotion, it's still, they're showing emotions.
Like a wildness, I think they explain it.
Right. And so the Sochas feel like they have to hide or cover that up, maybe even kind of ignore all the problems that are going on.
And you've also, within the outsiders, which would be, the greasers, you've also got this group of... I'd say Johnny and Pony Boy would be the most sensitive kind right. of people. So they're even outsiders
within the outsiders.
Yeah, within their own group.
Yeah. So who would you say you're related to you were a kid?
I was a Pony Boy. Totally.
100%.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't like people like Dallas Winston scared me. Like, I knew kids like that, and they made me nervous.
Yeah, I could see that.
Who are you?
Oh, probably hands down a 2-bit.
2-bit?
Yeah, it's kind of embarrassing. 2-bit. I'm maybe not as bad now, but yeah, I'm definitely a 2-bit.
I could see that. Let's talk about the movie. The movie was directed by Francis Ford Coppola. It kind of got on his radar because a middle school teacher in California had his class write to him and ask him to turn it into a movie. So he read the book, loved it, decided to make it.
Yeah, and you can definitely see themes. It follows the book. It does leave some bits out, especially a lot with the second half. But in my opinion, it's a pretty movie. I like the way it looks. I like the sunsets.
It looks like a old school production.
Right. You can definitely see the Gone with the Wind theme.
Yeah, and that's a theme in the book when they're trapped in the church.
And they're reading
Gone with the Wind.
Right. And you can see that that look in the movie. Kind of a nod.
Like the weird vignettes, and especially when they're like at the sunset.
The silhouettes against the sunset, yeah. So I don't remember, or I don't recall, or I wasn't aware that this was taking place in Tulsa, I guess, whenever I read the book or watched the movie. Maybe it was something that was brought up, but it just kind of skimmed my mind.
Or it would not be that big of a deal,
because
you're like, yeah,
you're
sure.
You're a kid, you're okay. Like, yeah, Tulsa, of course. Why wouldn't something take place in Tulsa?
Yeah.
Being from Oklahoma. What did kind of boggle my brain was finding out that Danny Boy O'Connor was in love with the movie so much that he was going to purchase the house where it was filmed in Tulsa. And that connection, Danny Boy O'Connor from House of Pain, I think everybody remembers the song Jump Around.
Yeah, huge hit.
Yeah, in the 90s, I won't sing.
I would say that song was inescapable.
It was inescapable. But yeah, I was like, what connection? So when I found that out, I was thinking, we have to have him in here and talk about this. Like, how did that come about?
Yeah, luckily enough, Jeff Moore, who is working on a museum in Tulsa for the Oklahoma Historical Society called OK Pop, which is all about Oklahomans and popular culture, through connections. Mary Beth hooked us up, and we got Danny Boy O'Connor. We had a member of House of Pain sitting right here.
We did, and he was amazing. So nice, so down to earth. Yeah, he was great.
So, yeah, we sat down with him. Let's go ahead and play that, and we'll be back in a while.
When I stepped out into the bright sunlight from the darkness of the movie house.
What brought me to Tulsa was music. We were playing Kane's Ballroom, but I fell in love with, the town itself. I came in 2009 when there was not a lot going on downtown, but I still felt like, wow, this is like the quintessential all-American city. You know, it had a Kane's Ballroom, which is, to me, it felt like the CBGBs of the Midwest, and that such stoic history, and the train would go through every 20 minutes and let the train whistle go off, and all this beautiful Art Deco downtown. I just thought, wow, this is, just felt, something felt different, and something was drawing me in. And then it occurred to me, my favorite movie, The Outsiders and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, they're neck and neck, and depending on what mood I'm in, but The Outsiders is probably up there. I mean, it is up there with my all-time favorite movies, and then it occurred to me that, oh my God, I think they filmed The Outsiders here. And so I started looking around for locations, and I found the locations, and it was mind-blowing.
Not all of us are like that.
Sure.
That's like saying all you greasers are like Dallas Winston. Anyway, you think the Soaps have it made? The rich kids, the South Side Soaps. Well, I'll tell you something, Pony Boy, and it might come as a surprise, but things are rough all over.
How were you introduced to The Outsiders? Was it like a prerequisite, like for reading, or did you watch
the movie?
I'm sure
it was. I just never read it until about 2 years ago. After, was like a, so I went to the movie when I was 13 when it first came out, mm-hmm. and the first week, you know, when it's released, I had no idea what I was going to see. And I went with one of the coolest kids in like eighth grade or ninth grade at that time, who, as soon as we came out of the movie, was like, man, it's great, but it's a little different from the book, dude. And I was like, book? Eighth grade, what are you reading for? Like, why would you want to read? And I just loved the movie for the fact that it, you know, it spoke to me. And I came from like a latchkey kid situation where my father was never around and my mother was always at work. And if I could just have a group of friends or a family that was like a gang that I could just run around with and have my best interests, and really all I just wanted to do was just chain smoke cigarettes and get a denim jacket, I would have been cool.
Yeah, hey.
At 13, that's, you know, it seems like a good plan. And I don't know, it was just so much different than what was going on in the 80s, you know, when you're thinking of E.T. and, you know, all the digital type of, yeah, and then this movie comes out of nowhere, and it's kind of like a, it's like a modern classic. It's like, it's scored by Francis's dad, you know, and
it's got that weird MGM
kind of feel. Yeah, it feels like a Gone with the Wind, slash, it should have been shot in Technicolor, or, and that in 83 is way different than everything else we're being, you know. And so, I don't know, I just, it's that romantic thing of like, you know, poor kid hanging out with a few, you know, trying to just, that class struggle.
Right.
And so I'm a transplant from New York to Woodland Hills, California in the San Fernando Valley, which is filled with like, they're filming Fast Times and Valley Girl and all that stuff in the surrounding areas and Sherman Oaks and Encino, Woodland Hills. So I felt more like the Karate Kid. I felt like this poor guy from the East Coast around all these people who had disposable incomes.
Right. And you're everything kind of a fish out of water.
Yeah. And so when The Outsiders came out, I was like, that's my thing. You know, that's my movie. That's my look. That's my whole. And so it kind of just was, that was the connection. You know, I just felt akin to it in that way. Never thinking in a million years that, you know, we'd be doing an Outsiders House museum and I'd be living in Tulsa and all that good stuff. But
so who'd you identify? I mean, everybody's got somebody they when you first saw it, who'd you identify with?
Were you Pony Boy?
Hell no. Hell no. Matt Dillon for sure. I mean, as a kid, I wanted to be Matt Dillon so bad it hurt, you know. Dallas Winston was like the coolest kid ever. And then I could relate to the Ralph Macchio Johnny character as well.
Yeah.
You know, I was in between age-wise of both of them, although that I think Ralph Macchio was like 25 when he shot that. He looked like the youngest guy, and he was the oldest
guy.
He was seriously like the oldest dude on that.
It's weird.
I know, because he doesn't look that
not
old.
Not at all.
But definitely Dallas Winston was like, you know, that's what everybody wanted to be
like.
My folks are worried about
me. Hey, man, the boys are worried. Do you know that Two-Bit wanted to go to Texas to hunt for you?
Yeah, I asked if my parents asked about me.
No, they didn't ask about you. So what? You think my old man gives a hang if I'm dead in a car wreck or drunk or in jail or something? He doesn't care. But that doesn't bother me none. Come on, you're not going anywhere.
I get you this hideout. I get you a hangout, man. A hideout. And look at this. Now you want to split. Gracious. This is terrific.
Johnny, you don't know what a few months of jail can do to you, man. Get mean in jail. I just don't want to see that happen to you like it happened to me, man. You understand?
So the house, you went out and scouted and you found the locations. Was the house for sale already? Or?
So when I first pulled up to the house, the house was for sale for $40,000, which, you know, not to sound like a, you know, a former Beverly Hills resident, but $40,000 doesn't buy a lot in Beverly Hills.
Oh, yeah.
So the hook was in my mouth, and I'm like, Danny, this is how you get in trouble. Stop messing with the idea of buying a house in Tulsa. You have no business buying a house in Tulsa. And although $40,000 is cheap for any house anywhere, still $40,000 is $40,000 at
it's
the
a
time.
Lot of money.
I'm still like, you know, $40,000, I have it, but I don't. And so I let the idea go. Every couple of months, I would think about it. Man, I wonder what they're doing with that house. How come they don't turn that house into a museum? And every time I would cross the U.S., we would go. You know, I do a lot of road trips with my wife, and being on the road in a band, and you know, you kind of go crisscross back and forth the U.S. And so anytime we were coming anywhere near Oklahoma, I would always try to make a pilgrimage and get somebody else hyped on it. Remember that movie? I know where the house is. Let me show you. Oh, yeah, I'd love to see it. So it was in worse shape every year. So I'd go see it, and then and the following year, I'd be like, oh, it looks a little rougher and a little bit more, you know, downtrodden. And
was anybody living there? Or
yeah, there was someone living there. So the fastest way to tell the long story is that the house turned over in like 2007. The owner's son, so the guy who rented the house to Francis Ford Coppola at that time, Louis Priest was his name, and his son inherited the house when he passed. but wasn't able to keep it up and lost it to the taxes because low taxes on that house. But yeah. I think they were getting zooted in there. So I'm not saying he was. I think he was.
Right, yeah.
So I heard it through the grapevine. And then the people I got it from, they bought it to Fluff and Buffett. They were thinking museum, but it was like a far-fetched idea.
Yeah.
I don't think they were internet savvy. And, as we grow on the internet and,
yeah.
I have a good, nice size, following and footprint, And so it was a little bit easier for me to reach out to people. But so they ended up using it as a rental property. And then the lady I bought it from, it was her husband who bought the house. And then he passed away soon after. And she was like, I'm done. I'm going to Florida to retire. And it was a rental property for her.
Okay.
And the tenants were just not taking care of it. Matter of fact, they were 8 months behind on rent when I had approached her and asked her, if she ever was willing to sell it, would she give us a call? And she said, I'm ready to sell, so.
Hey, tell me, Pony Boy, what's it like being a hero, huh? Or what? A hero, man, like a big shot, even. Beer for breakfast every 2 bit.
What I like is the turn hero bit there. You're charging Johnny with manslaughter?
Well, I mean, if he recovers.
Also says how you saved them kids, Pony Boy. Had they burned, death hadn't been for you.
Well, Dallas will be mad when he hears that he didn't make this police record.
Ain't that true?
It's all about us. Dairy, me, and soda.
What was your first piece of memorabilia, of Outsiders memorabilia?
Well, I've been collecting stuff on eBay in a weird way of Fast Times and The Outsiders and a few other things. And so the original poster that we all know as it looks like a burgundy poster and they're all laughing. It's the one that Essie Hinton doesn't like because she's like, there's nothing funny about it in the book. And
the
movie company did that. And apparently there was a joke told while they were doing that photo shoot. I think C. Thomas Howell told Leif Garrett, he was trying to grab from Kraft Food Service while they were doing their photo shoot. And he said, hey, man, don't touch that. That's for the actors. And they all started to laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it was
him
candid,
a non-actor.
It was a candid shot.
It was a candid shot, and they ended up using that. But there's a B version to the poster, which is an illustrated poster by a guy named David Grove. And it just looks like an old 50s/ book cover.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a tie-in book cover that they used in the 80s for that as well. But it was a cooler one. So I'd always wanted that poster, but that poster is pretty rare. And they come up all the time. I think there's a few bootlegs online, but they go for $250 a pop. So
mm-hmm.
I was always looking for little trinkets, but the B version poster was the first one. And then when I found the house in 2009, when I found it for myself, I was more interested in starting to collect Outsider stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the last couple of years when I started thinking, this is I might get this house. And, it kind of just all fell together. And then I just ramped it up and just started buying everything I could that was on the open market and signing up for all kinds of auction houses just in case it came up.
Something came up, yeah.
And then once we put the word out that we got the house and we're doing a museum, then it's, it attracts all kinds of stuff. So we had, out of the blue, I got an email from a woman who's married to a retired Tulsa PD. And I knew that the Coppola chair had been stolen from the set of Rumblefish. And they saw the theft and they said, you know what, if he wants that chair, let him have it. We're making a movie here. Focus,
Yeah.
So the chair disappears off set. And a week later, the Tulsa PD gets called out to a location. They say, this guy's drunk behind our store. He's living back here and he's playing on the trains. And we don't want him to kill himself. So will you come out here? And he said, he pulled up and hit him with the light. And he said, wait a minute, whose chair is that? And he's like, that chair? That's not my chair. You want that chair? And I was like, yeah, you put that chair in my car and get your stuff and get out of here. So the chair was in his man cave for 34 years when he realized we were doing a museum.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came through and was like, listen, I got something that's priceless and I want to, give it to you guys. And
so he donated it to you.
Yeah.
That's
and
awesome.
Then Essie Hinton gave me Matt Dillon's leather jacket that she had from the film and a bunch of call sheets and dailies and notes and all kinds of good stuff like that.
So was it always going to, were you thinking about possibly
living there? Hell
living there?
Yeah. That's where the Pony Boy thing comes in. That's where I'm like, I'm going to stay in that room and this will be my private fantasy cave and I'll hang my little collection in and let a few select kids in to just, look at this collection, But so when I bought the house, there's, I bought it sight unseen, basically. I have no idea on home restoration or repairing.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't know the first thing about doing this. And then when I got that house, it's a 100-year-old house.
Yeah.
A lot of people didn't know that. And if you look online on Zillow, it comes up as a 40s house, but 40s in the 40s is when they moved it to its current location. It originally started in downtown Tulsa on 7th and Elgin.
Oh, crazy.
And they moved it in the 40s. And when I got there, I mean, the house is not on a cement slab. It's basically piered. Uh-huh. So it's like, and those things settle. And
especially in Oklahoma.
Yep.
Trust me, so, I live in a fun house.
You do? Yeah, so the same thing. The best description, it felt like a fun house. So some floors were bowed, some were dipping, and corners of the door jam. I mean, it just, doors don't shut because everything, and so the only thing that house needed was a complete new house, and I didn't know the first thing about doing that. And so it quickly became like, you know, hey, let me go see if I can raise some money so I can get some help here. Because, again, you know, I didn't pay $40,000 for the house. I paid $15,000 for the house, which is super cheap.
Yeah.
But looking back, I mean, it was a fair deal. I mean, obviously, when people see it all done, they're like, wow, you stole that thing. Yeah. But what I bought for the money, I mean, was, at the time, if it wasn't the outsider's house, I would have felt like it was only worth a couple grand because it was derelict.
I mean,
roaches and just you name it. It was like tons of it, too.
It probably would have been torn down eventually if you didn't save it.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. Because so that neighborhood, they're tearing down pieces of the neighborhood and they're building Habitat for Humanity homes in there, which I'm a fan of. I'm an advocate. I'd actually help them do that, but not in lieu of tearing down what I believe to be a historic location.
Missed
this one.
Yeah.
I'll help you down the block all you want once we're done with this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage it, especially if it's like drug infested, derelict, like trap houses. Like, tear them down and build some stuff so people can, you know, have a
nice houses. Yeah.
Right. But I don't think anybody was, you know, worried about that at the time. And I thought, you know, that nobody cares about this house because if it's so cheap and I'm the only one, but I was wrong and pleasantly so. So what, you know, I feel like I got the ball rolling, but I stepped back after that and I was just, I humbled myself enough to say, listen, I might be 6'6", alpha male, but I don't know the first thing about like ripping out drywall or fixing the floors or doing, and would you help? And so, you know, people came out of the woodworks.
And started helping. So how are the renovations going? Are they getting
there? Yeah, they're going good. We've had a few pauses in the sense that, you know, people get busy in their personal lives or people get, you know, they come in hot and then it gets, you know, bored after a while. And then
so
it gets,
is it a lot of volunteers?
Well, it's a few different people that have volunteered steadily through the process.
Mm-hmm.
And they have businesses, they've got kids, they got stuff. And then I noticed that when I was not in town full time that, you know, it would slow down a lot.
Right.
Because then the morale wasn't there. Yeah. I started coming back and forth a lot more. And then finally I was like, listen, if I'm going to be real with this thing and this going to do this thing justice, then I need to be here full time in Oklahoma than just phone it in.
Right.
I didn't want to be that absentee guy. Like, I started on it. You guys go fix that for me and then let me know when it's done. And fortunately enough, like I said, I fell in love with Tulsa as well. The people, the culture, the pride. I got such a good welcoming committee every time I'd come through and all the help that I got. I felt like, you know, this is right for me. And my wife, you know, she felt the same. And
good.
So we're here. We're living at the Mayo Hotel. And, you know, we go in to the house a few times a week and either let the people come in that are working on this or, you know, just we're just running around campaigning. So whether it's doing podcasts one day, the next day it's going to get the cement pillars from the original fountain, and the next day it's, you know, it could be anything. Some days the best we can do is feed the stray cats. And sometimes I got to remember that because California moves at a lot faster pace. That's one thing I got to be honest with you guys about.
Oh, yeah. Trust me.
Oh, no, so we know. We're slow.
I'm like, you know, I want this stuff to happen overnight. And so I'm like, come on, you know. And so there'll be days where I'm like, this is never going to open. We're not doing it fast enough. And then somebody might even go, well, what's going on over there? When is this thing going to open on the internet? Because there's nothing better to do. And then I'm like, man, they're right. We're dragging ass and we're messing this up. And we're not. It is what it is, you know? If I still had House of Pain money from the 90s when, like, we first started doing House of Pain records, I would have loved to come in and big shot everybody and big leagued everybody. And here, you know, here's a couple hundred and just fix that up there. Yeah, just, you know, let me give this as a gift. You know, do all that kind of, you know. But that's not the situation. The situation is I bought that house for 15 grand. At the time, I had 28 grand in cash. That was my whole worth, 28 grand. There's been times where $28 was a lot, and there's been times 28 grand was pocket money for me.
Yeah.
But I made more an accident in the 90s than I make more than I make on purpose in this era. Okay. Yeah. So I put my money where my mouth was. It was 15 to get in the game.
Mm-hmm. So you're
and
in.
Then it was another yeah. $5,000 to move out the tenants and get them situated, mm-hmm. you know, for $4,800 and driving my car back and forth because I couldn't yeah. afford flights.
The
and
gas.
It was cheaper to just to do a car. And then I didn't have to rent a car when I got here. And I stayed on couches for months. I stayed on, you know, and I was going back enough to, like, for my wife to go, listen, I want to, like, we got to talk. Yeah, like, yeah. what's going on, you know? And so I put it all on the line. So I don't want people to think also that, you know, I just kind of pulled up, stole somebody's house,
right.
let the locals do the work, and then bailed out. Like, we're committed to this thing.
You've got blood, sweat, and tears
yeah,
in
and I'm passionate about it. And I'm just one of the many cogs in the machine. You know, mm-hmm. there have been so many people. I could sit here and, you know, make a roll call of all the help I've got. But believe me, it's a team mm-hmm. of people. And when, you know, some bail out, new ones come in, and some have been there from day mm-hmm. one. And it's just been a crazy experience. It's like, you know, this is my first museum, dude. Like, who
yeah,
knew? Like,
yeah.
I'm not like
this
was not in the plans. That there's no real blueprint. And it's museum is kind of a misnomer because it's like my original intent was just to save the house.
Yeah.
Just to save it. Just to make sure that they didn't wreck it. That was my number one thing. And
right.
for bragging rights, yeah, we got the house. You know, like, hey, we saved it. We got it. We don't know what we're doing with it,
but
it ain't
that.
Going nowhere.
Yeah.
And that if I got that done, I would have felt good about it.
Right.
We've surpassed that. We've had two events already. We brought out Ralph Macchio. We brought out C. Thomas Howell mm-hmm. twice. We brought out Darren Dalton, the tall soul. Essie Hinton's been involved since day one. She wrote us a nice check for $10,000, gave us the leather jacket.
Oh, man.
Yeah, nice.
We've had everybody, you know, from all walks of life, you know, people with the least to give have given the most in the sense that they've given their time and
mm-hmm.
their expertise and come over after work with a few extra tiles and lay the tile in front of the fireplace that was missing and on their mm-hmm. arm, you know, from leftover job sites that they were like, this would be really cool there. Do you mind if we be able, you know, people have done a lot. So
right. It's
right now the world needs a feel good story. This is the feel good story
yeah.
for me
yeah.
in my world because I, you know, I watch the news, I'm on the internet. I'm like, what is going on? And then
yeah.
all of a sudden I got to remember there's still like a lot of good stuff going on in
yeah.
between all the
and good people
external,
who care about
of
these
course.
Things.
And
yeah.
so, originally, like I said, I was scared that nobody cared because if they did, why was this house so available? Why was I able to pull up? And what I've also found out that other people have tried, and at the time, she wasn't selling. So somebody said, I offered her 50, even though that was a couple grand, that was $20,000 more than we could spend, and she wouldn't come off the 60 number. And that was a year before I found the lady's number and got a hold of her. So apparently
timing.
A couple years
yeah.
ago, she wasn't selling.
Right.
Or she wanted $60,000. Where that number came from originally when I saw them buy it or they were trying to fluff and buff it, they wanted $44,000. So it was timing. I
right.
like to think it was destiny. I mean,
yeah.
I
yeah.
believe it was. But for 15, that's a sharp dip from the 60. I think she just had it with the thing and was just like
ready to
let
get
go.
Rid of it.
And so,
yeah.
and I came out of the blue too. She said, I remember she was being sarcastic, but she said, you know, that's a double property. And if you didn't come out of nowhere now, I would have separated that on you and charged you another 15 for that side. But, I said, well, good thing I come out of nowhere because I don't got the other 15, you know.
So what do you need now? Like, what do you have a –
you know what? It changes day to day. So mm-hmm. the house is 90% restored. I mean, it looks like a
– does it look like the movie? Like,
no, 100%. Yeah,
that's
I mean, we
awesome.
Made sure that we just did it to spec everywhere we could. The hard part is, like, you know, we early on in press, we were saying, oh, we're going to make it all staged just like it was in the movie. That
mm-hmm.
proved to be a lot harder than
yeah.
we first thought. That being said, the kitchen was redone, all the cabinets from photos from the original kitchen in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Tulsa Kitchen Concepts, a local Tulsan cabinet maker and, you know, the best vendor in Tulsa for that
mm-hmm.
stuff. They remade our original door, which was thrown away. It was a 100-year-old door that was in the movie. It had a very unique, and it was very high. It was like a 8 to 9 foot high
oh.
door type of, because
mm-hmm.
the house is 100 years old, so
right.
it had different
so it
features.
Different dimensions,
yeah.
windows.
So
are
they
all
made
different.
A custom one, and then they made the custom kitchen for us. And so that looks like it does. It just needs to be faux finished now. It needs to be painted the correct way to
yeah.
stage it to
make
look.
It look like.
Yes, and we put vintage linoleum down that we imagined what would have been there. We didn't. There's no reference photos from it. A friend of mine bought an old stove from the same people who sold the original stove to the movie company
mm-hmm.
that made it. And we have a vintage refrigerator that was donated. The guy went and bought it in Detroit from Chicago and then drove it from Detroit to Tulsa and then went back to Chicago. And, you know, when he went to buy the stove, he told him what it was, the refrigerator. He said, yeah, this is for the outsider's house. house. The guy goes, oh, I love the Outsider's house, man. Give me $20 less. And he goes, yeah, it's for my boy Danny Boy. He's like, oh, how's the pay? He, give me $50 or whatever. It was $150 bucks, but he gave him $50 off or something like that. So we've been, anytime we tell the story or anytime they see us with the T-shirts on or whatever, people are like, oh, man, you're involved with that or that movie. I love that movie. Or I read the book and, you know.
I was crazy. You know that kid? I was crazy about wanting Johnny to stay out of trouble, man. If he was smart like me, he wouldn't have been in this mess. If he was smart like me, he wouldn't have ran in that church, man. You better wise up, boy, man. You just better wise up, man. You get tough like me and you don't get hurt. Watch out for yourself and nothing can touch you, man.
It's just timing is everything. I think right now is the time. I think we lose these things a lot, unfortunately. And then when it goes, we're like, oh my gosh, you know. And so I think especially our generation, now that we're like in power, if you will, or we're at that age that we're like, you know what, maybe we should start like looking at these a little, you know, like a little bit more sacred and try to preserve it and keep it. If I can bow tie this and be like all the rap stuff and all that outside stuff, that was cool. But on my Wikipedia page, when it says, like, bought the Outsider's house, turned into a museum, and kids from all over the world and adults as well enjoy going over there and seeing the collection and reading the book. And
you got your inner Daryl going on.
Yeah, I feel like I'm good, you know? Like, I feel like that's a good mitzvah for me. Yeah. I feel like, you know, all the rah-rah stuff and all that alpha male stuff in my youth was cool. But now I'm at the point where if they used to say, yo, that's Danny Boy from House of Pain. And now they're starting to go, hey, is that guy from the Outsider's house? And I'm like, yeah. You know, like the metamorphosis like, has been complete.
Just adds on to your legacy.
Yeah, and I feel like this is a new legacy. I needed a change anyway. You know, I'm 48 years old, heading to 49 in December. You know, one can only jump around so long. Well, and you know what I mean? And it's like, I want to do something where I'm more grounded and centered and focused, and Tulsa seems like the right place for me.
So. Oh, that's awesome.
Well, and yeah, I know, you're like, definitely an honorary Okie now.
So. Absolutely. Nice. All of us in Oklahoma, thank you for doing this.
Listen, I thank all of Oklahoma for helping me do this because, again, we'd still be – it was just – I would have bought the house, locked it up, and then been like, what now? Because I didn't know what to do, and so – Oklahoma saved this house as much as, you know, I just feel like I pushed a rock that was ready to roll anyway, so.
We're all proud of you, buddy. It's gonna be all right.
Pony boy. Stay gold. Pony boy.
Okay, and that's the end of the podcast. We want to thank Danny O'Connor so much for taking the time to come down and
chat with us.
Yeah, I was humbled. I mean, he's a big deal.
Yeah, he is a big deal.
And we're not.
No, not yet.
Keep up with a follow on Twitter and Facebook, The Outsider's House, and keep updated and go visit it when it opens. It's a great project and a great piece of Tulsa and film history that's being preserved, and his collection sounds amazing.
Yeah, and it's just a straight shot up the turnpike. So tune in 2 weeks when we're going to be talking about what's up with the panhandle.
Yeah, we're going to answer all your panhandle related questions like
why?
why does it exist? Thanks for listening. Give us a shout on Twitter. We also follow us on Facebook now. You can just search for us at A Very Okay Facebook. How does it work?
You just find A Very Okay Podcast on.
Just
you can search it.
Yeah, search for it.
Hey, Corey.
Yeah.
Stay gold.